You know what you're listening to?
Is that a trick question?
It's the I Still Love This Game podcast with your host, Matthew Damien.
He's an idiot. Don't listen to he's an idiot.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to episode 21 of the I Still Love This Game podcast. In this week's episode, we're going to be taking a look at Allen Iverson's career. And what really sparked this was a question that I received about a month ago, and I only just got around to it. And it was a meme that was going around late last season, and it involved Isaiah Thomas, the current Isaiah Thomas, not the Detroit Pistons Isaiah Thomas, so the guy that currently plays on the Cavs, but he played on the Celtics at the time. And it was a comparison, a very, very vague comparison of Iverson's stats and Isaiah Thomas's stats when they were both 27 years of age. And what that did, what that meme did, was really ignite a conversation as to, is Isaiah Thomas actually reaching the levels of play of Allen Iverson around his prime? Not at his prime, and we'll get to that, but it was around his prime. So we're going to be talking primarily about Iverson's career and what made him an iconic player of his generation. I wouldn't say he was the best player of his generation, but absolutely an iconic player. And people that grew up with him and played against him have nothing but respect for him. So let's begin at the meme. And it's talking about, as I said, Iverson. It's a comparison between Iverson and Thomas at the age of 27. Points per game, Iverson 27.6, Thomas 27.8. Field goal percentage, Iverson 41.4, Thomas 45.3. 3-point percentage, 27.7 for Iverson, 36.4 for Thomas. Foul shooting, 77.4 for Iverson, 90.5, so nearly 91 for Thomas. Assist per game, 5.5. For Iverson, 6.4 for Thomas, and minutes per game, 42.5 for Iverson, and 33.5 for Isaiah Thomas. So if you're just reading the box score, or not even the box score, but if you're just reading the statistics, there's no contest here. And that's Isaiah Thomas is the much more efficient player. But of course, basketball goes a lot deeper than that, and I think you guys know that. They're not robots out there, and it's the different circumstances for both these guys, and because of that, there's context that needs to be applied. Allen Iverson, boy, where do you even begin with this guy? The comparison's flawed immediately because Iverson wasn't even playing point guard at that. So the assist per game and all that, you can throw all that out the window because he wasn't even playing point. He wasn't meant to be initiating the offense. And he was never the most efficient player. Now, I would challenge anybody, and this includes Jordan and Olajuwon, and guys that have won with very little help on the offensive end. I have to put offensive end because obviously Scottie Pippen was a great help to Jordan on the defensive end. But on the offensive end, Iverson had absolutely nothing to work with. He never had a consistent player to work with. The only time he had an all-star during his prime in Philadelphia was Dikembe Mutombo, who was 34. And Dikembe Mutombo was actually playing for Atlanta in the All-Star game. It was after the All-Star game they made the trade because Theo Ratliff blew out his knee. So I looked up, and I got this ready. This is pretty much the only research I've got in front of me apart from that one meme. And what I have in front of me right now is Allen Iverson's teammates during the 2003 season, which is when he was 27 years of age. So let's look at this roster to apply some context. Eric Snow, 12 points per game. Keith Van Horn, who was, oh my goodness, I don't even know where to begin with this. Keith Van Horn started his career and looked like he could have been something pretty special in the NBA. Great shooter, pretty athletic, not a bad defender, not a great defender either, not a bad rebounder, but also not a terrific one either. But what he was able to do in New Jersey as a rookie was quite impressive. However, he definitely did not live up to expectations following that rookie season in New Jersey. And he was ultimately traded for Mutombo, and the Nets actually didn't use Mutombo at all during their playoff run. And had they used Mutombo in their playoff run, they may have even knocked off the Spurs in the 2003 finals, because he gave Duncan fits in his limited minutes, because he was able to, because of his reach, he was able to really contest Duncan on his shooting and still have the foot speed to somewhat recover without Duncan just getting to the lane and shooting that little jump hook. Regardless, that's for another topic. Anyway, they had traded Mutombo for Keith Van Horn, and what, so Keith Van Horn was their second best scorer. And then you've got Kenny Thomas, Aaron McKee, who was a good player during their playoff run in 2001, but at this stage he was only averaging 9 points per game, and he's he was down to 43% as a field goal percent in his as a field goal percentage, which is not good. Iverson's was less, but Iverson was carrying this team. As a supplementary player, you have to do a better job than that. I'm sorry. Derek Coleman, 35. Tyron Hill, 34. Todd McCulloch, who was a third-string center for them during their run to the finals a couple of seasons prior to that, he was pretty much their starting center. So the point I'm making here is Iverson had to carry that entire load by himself. And during that era, this is, we're starting, the 2003 is still kind of, you know, you still got remnants of the 90s and the 80s, you know, with a physical slowdown, half-court basketball. It's nothing like what you see today. And Iverson was taking a beating night in, night out. And let me just pull this back up. I want to see how many games he played. Actually, no, Iverson did play all 82 games, so kudos to him. But that was a rarity, especially in Philly, for him to play that many games. And the point I'm making here is you compare that to Isaiah Thomas playing in a pathetic Eastern Conference. Now, the Eastern Conference was pretty bad in 2003 too, but it was nowhere near as shocking as what it was last year. And it's comparing apples to oranges. The only thing similar about these guys is they could score and they were smaller players. But Iverson was never a terrible defender. He was never a great defender either, by the way. But he was never a shockingly bad defender. You couldn't just isolate him and go at him the way that you could do with Isaiah Thomas. And the point I'm trying to make here is one of the biggest criticisms for Iverson is that he shot too much. He didn't have enough. First of all, he was playing with a great coach, a very strong personality and a coach in Larry Brown. If that wasn't by design, then Iverson would have been either traded or he would have adapted his game. Larry Brown structured their entire offense based on Iverson shooting the ball that much because that was their only chance in winning. And that was the only reason Philly was competitive, let alone contenders, for that entire period. I guess the point I'm trying to make here in a very roundabout way is if we're going to make a comparison between Thomas and Iverson, let's switch them. Do we think that with Isaiah Thomas from last year, if we put them on the 2001 or the 2002 team or even the 2003 team, Philly would be better? My answer is no to that. Absolutely not. Now, if we do the same thing and we put Iverson in his prime or even at the age of 27 when he really wasn't in his prime but he's still posting big numbers, if we put them on that on Boston's team last year, do I think Boston is better? Yeah, I think they are, especially if you've got Avery Bradley, because that's a big component to it all, because he can play the role of Eric Snow, but with a jump shot, where he can defend the larger shooting guards, and Iverson can defend the smaller point guards, which is really what they did anyway in Philly. And it was a big reason they were able to play Iverson in a traditional scoring role as opposed to playing point guard. So to me, there's no comparison. If you look at it, it comes down to, are you just going to look at stats and you're going to think the players are robots or not? And if you do that, you're going to interpret the numbers and you're going to crunch the numbers like an accountant would and say, no, Thomas is the more effective player. He's the better player at the age of 27. But once you apply that context of the era, of his teammates, of his role on the team, and if you put Isaiah Thomas on that, where he doesn't have Al Horford, he doesn't have Brown, he doesn't have Morris, he doesn't have any of those guys, he doesn't have Bradley, he doesn't have... And suddenly he's in a situation where he has to carry that entire offense by himself, I can't see how anybody who's watched either of these guys play would think that's a reasonable comparison. I tell you what, if you take Isaiah Thomas, I'll be very happy to take Iverson after him. I'd be incredibly happy to take AI after him. And the reason for that is, we're going to get into his career, I guess, now. And there's very few players with the same kind of willpower that Iverson had. And I can't help but think back to that run that he had in 2001. And I'll ramble on a bit here about that run whilst I look it up. Because that was his MVP season. And a lot of people, that was kind of an odd year. No team won 60 wins that year. The Spurs came close, but the Sixers won 56, and the Lakers won 56. So they actually had a tied record, but because of tiebreaker rules, the Lakers had the number one seed. Regardless, Iverson, next best player. Now, it would have been very interesting, as I said in the Joe Smith podcast, and I genuinely believe that. I wasn't just saying that because Joe was on the show. Had the 76ers kept Joe Smith and Theo Ratliff didn't get injured, and they also had Tony Kukoc, because they had to throw in Tony Kukoc as well to get to Kembe Mutombo, that's a completely different series, because you're not missing out much defensively. If anything, you're probably getting better defensively. Not with Kukoc, because George Lynch took his minutes. Same with Jermaine Jones, who ended up starting in the finals. But Theo Ratliff was a fantastic defender. He would have been Defensive Player of the Year that year had he not got injured. And if you had someone like Joe Smith, who was, we saw going up against David Robinson, of course, David Robinson isn't Shaq, but still, Joe Smith was fearless. And even if he's just coming over on help, he could have really helped nullify Shaq. Not nullify. I mean, that's a bad choice of words. Put it this way, Joe Smith would have done a better, much better job than what Tyron Hill did, especially in that series. Now, you look at what Iverson had to work with to get to the finals. You look at what he had to go through to get to the finals. As I said, the East was pretty bad then, but it was nowhere near as bad as what we've seen in the last few seasons. This year has been it's been a gift from God that it's been as competitive as what it is. But Iverson and the 76ers, they went through the Pacers. The Pacers made the finals the year before. But they did some rebuilding. They traded one of their all-stars, Dale Davis, and they got Jermaine O'Neal. Jermaine O'Neal was only 21 or 22 years of age at that time, but he was still very effective as a shot blocker and was starting to develop some post moves. He wasn't the level that we would get accustomed to seeing there, where he became a dominant big man. But you still had Reggie Miller. You still had Jalen Rose. And you also had some role players that were big in getting the Pacers to the finals, such as Austin Crozier and Travis Best. So they weren't a bad team at all, and they had to face them in the first round, and Reggie Miller hit a game-winning shot in the end of Game 1. Iverson responded with a 55-point performance. I don't have it in front of me, but it was an incredible performance in Game 2. And it was actually a very underrated shootout. Everyone wants to talk about what Iverson did with Carter in the next series, but that game, the first half of Game 2 was incredible between those two, because Reggie Miller was on fire, and there was, you know, if you watch that game, you could sort of listen to the Philadelphia crowd sort of hold their breath a little bit, because all of a sudden, look, if Iverson doesn't match what Reggie Miller's doing, there was a great chance that Philly would go down 2-0, and in a best-of-five situation, if you lose the first two at home, that's even more of a death wish than if you lose the first two at home in a best out of seven, because you have to run off three straight. If you go down 0-2 in a best of seven, you still can lose one more game in that series and you could still pull yourself out of it. Of course, you have to go to the game seven at that stage, as both situations are not desirable. But if you make me pick which one I want, I would prefer to go down 0-2 in a best of seven as opposed to a best of five. Regardless, Iverson had to go through that Pacers team. He then had to go through the Raptors, and this is Vince Carter in his prime. And that was an incredible series. Both Allen Iverson and Carter averaged over 30 a game in that series. And they kind of went back and forth. Once again, the Raptors stole home court advantage, just like the Pacers did in Game 1. Iverson came back with a big performance in game two. Then Vince Carter set a record for most threes and a half without a miss in a playoff game. The Sixers clawed their way back in game four and won a very scrappy game. Iverson was named MVP the next night, had 55, I think it was, in game five. Game six, the Raptors won. And game seven, it came down to a last second shot by Carter and he just missed it. It was very close. And it could have very easily have gone. It was kind of like a situation where you see certain teams lose and you're like, they were the better team. And when you watch that series with Antonio Davis and Vince Carter, obviously, Morris Peterson was playing very well, as was Charles Oakley. They just, Alvin Williams as well as a point guard, very good defensive point guard. I got the feeling that that Raptors team was better than that Sixers team. I'm not saying Carter was better than Iverson, but he was very close to him. And the supporting cast, at least on the offensive end, was superior. And it was, honestly, it was Iverson's will in some of those games that got them over the line in game two and game five, you know, 50-point performances. How many guys not named Michael Jordan have had 50-point performances in one playoff series? Regardless, there was that was a seven-game series. And then the next series, they ran it into Milwaukee. And Milwaukee had a very questionable big three. I'm not going to call them a big three. They had Glenn Robinson, Ray Allen, and Sam Cassell. And they were loaded in that backcourt because these guys are all perimeter scorers. I guess you could say Glenn Robinson was more of a mid-range scorer, but his range extended out to the three-point line. Sam Cassell was a fiery guy. Obviously, he won a couple of titles in his first years with Houston. Very good leader. And Ray Allen was emerging as a sleeper in the discussions of who was the best shooting guard. Obviously, you had Iverson, you had Kobe, you had T-Mac, you had Vince Carter. All of a sudden, Ray Allen, deadly, deadly shooter, could play defense, could put the ball on the floor as well. People were starting to... say we should be throwing his name in the mix as well with all of this. And they pushed Iverson and the 76ers to seven games as well. So if you're keeping tabs here, out of a potential, 19, out of a potential 19 games to get to the finals, maximum, they have to play 18. So they're only one game off playing the maximum games to reach the finals. And they had to do all of that on the back of Iverson with very little offensive help to really supplement Iverson. And that's why when you look at a lot of his games, when Philly was winning, he was scoring a lot. When he wasn't scoring a lot, they pretty much lost because they had no one else to go to. So it wasn't a case of him being selfish with the ball and trying to score. He had to score. There's a big difference. He wasn't just running up these numbers in order to pad his stats. And then, of course, they ran into the Lakers. Now, the Lakers, that team was maybe the best I've ever seen a team play. Not just in the playoffs, but overall. They had a lot of drama during the regular season. Obviously, with Shaq and Kobe, they were the defending champions. They traded Glenn Rice, brought in Horace Grant. They promoted Rick Fox to the starting lineup. And then There was tensions between Shaq and Kobe, whose team was it, blah, 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 we all know that. But come playoff time, they even just before playoff game, they clicked it into a gear that, as I said, there's very few teams that you can even mention in the same breath as the 2001 Lakers. And they ran through the Portland Trail Blazers, who were on paper a better team than what they were a year before, and pushed the Lakers to seven games, and they swept them. And then following that, they came up against the Sacramento Kings, who led by Chris Webber, Vlade Divac, Peja was on that team as well. And so Jason Williams was still on this team. It wasn't Mike Bibby. So they weren't quite as good as what they were the year later. But the year later, they did push them to seven as well, the year later. This Sacramento Kings team was promptly swept. And if we're talking about the year prior, this was essentially the same team as the year prior, and the Sacramento Kings pushed them to an elimination game. They pushed them to a game five in the first round. And next up was the San Antonio Spurs, led by Tim Duncan, David Robinson, and all those guys, a couple of years earlier, they swept the Lakers out of the playoffs. And they really forced Laker management to bring in Phil Jackson. And three guesses what the Lakers did to him this this time around. They swept them. So they looked pretty much unstoppable. And here they were coming up against Allen Iverson and the 76ers. Iverson drops 48 on them. You know, and it wasn't just 48 points. It was one of the most transcendent games. I was going to say iconic, but that doesn't even do it. One of the most transcendent games. If you show somebody who doesn't even know basketball, you show them that game, they'll appreciate what they see. If they love sports, they will be able to appreciate the performance that Allen Iverson had that game. That Philly was down 16-5. You keep in mind what I just told you, the road that they had to get to the finals and how they were honestly lucky to get to the finals. They only got there through determination. It wasn't talent. They didn't have a whole lot of talent there. They weren't as talented as the Raptors, and they certainly weren't as talented as the Bucks. And then they're running up against one of the best, if not the best, team of all time. At least they were on the best run, maybe, of all time in NBA history. They're down 16-5. It's in LA. By all intents and purposes, this should have been a blowout. And the guy that turned this game on its head was Iverson, who ended up with 30 in that first half and completely changed the momentum of that game. Shaq had 44, I think it was, 44 and 20. And that wasn't enough to offset what Iverson did. Iverson ended up averaging 35 for that series. Yes, he shot bad. But he was going up against Kobe, who was a pretty good defender. Tyronn Lue, excellent defender. Derek Fisher, excellent defender. I'm talking about for smaller guys, right? And he still averaged 35. If we're going to talk Iverson versus Isaiah Thomas, do we really think Isaiah Thomas had that kind of impact? If anything, if we look at Isaiah Thomas last year in the conference finals, the Cavs rolled in without home court advantage, and they blew the Celtics out the first two games. Isaiah Thomas gets injured, and then the Celtics win game three without Isaiah Thomas. And they were highly competitive for most of game four. So if we're being honest here, in the moment of truth, the Celtics played a lot better without Isaiah Thomas in the playoffs than they did with him in those critical moments. Now, of course, Isaiah Thomas had some good moments too, especially against the Wizards in the second round. But let's not forget how badly he played in that first round. I get it, you know, his sister passed away and everything like that, but he was being outplayed by Rajon Rondo, who no one really wanted at that point. He played a decent season in Sacramento statistically, but the market wasn't set on fire for him as a free agent. And he ended up going to Chicago, and Chicago was pretty much a train wreck the entire season. And Chicago, had Rondo not gotten injured, Chicago would have been the team that knocked them off. And then we don't know what would have happened with the Wizards. It would have been, you know, a flip of a coin between the Wizards and the Bulls. The point I'm trying to make here is Iverson, the Sixers won, got so far, and they won the Eastern Conference. And they're taking a game against that Lakers team. No other team took a game off them. Winning one game against them is almost worthy of close to a championship in of itself. And for them to get that far on the back of Iverson without any other consistent offensive talent, it shows what a wonderful player he was. Can you imagine how good this guy would have been had he had played with somebody who could actually make his job better? Imagine if he played with a Jason Kidd instead of an Eric Snow. Someone who could actually get him the ball and get him easier looks, better scoring opportunities. He never had that. So the comparison is as absurd as you could possibly. It's almost as bad as the Jordan-LeBron thing. Because you just got a bunch of people looking at stats and saying, well, look at this. This is so much better than this player from the 90s. Okay, if we're going to go that route, then let's compare the players of today as to the players of the 60s and the 70s and some of the numbers they were putting up. Let's compare any time that DeMarcus Cousins does anything of value, let's compare that to what Wilt Chamberlain was doing. Any time that LeBron James throws up a triple-double, let's compare that to what Oscar Robertson was doing. I don't think you want to go down that route, because it's a different game then. And it was a different game in the 90s too. And I guarantee you Isaiah Thomas would not be anywhere near MVP consideration. He really wasn't last year too. It was just sort of a fun little side note to the rest of the season. It was always between James Harden and Russell Westbrook. There was no one else was a serious contender to that award. But to answer the question, or to respond to that meme, that's how I feel about it. The greatest test is if you ran either of those teams, so say the Celtics, and you had a trade proposal come through to you, Allen Iverson for Isaiah Thomas, bam, you take that in half a second. The same breath. You wouldn't even take another breath. You'd be like, yeah, okay, cool. But if you were running the 76ers and they offered you Isaiah Thomas for Iverson, would you take it? And I'd have to say they wouldn't. And I know I wouldn't. And if you would, then believe me, I'll be sending you a whole lot more trade requests after that one. The funny thing in all of this is Iverson's best season may have actually been the 2005 season. I've always said that he should have been MVP that year and not Steve Nash. People think that Shaq should have been the MVP over Steve Nash. And their argument for it is, well, look at how bad the Lakers were after Shaq left and how good Miami was with Shaq. I mean, that's a sort of semi-decent argument, but you've got to take into account the Lakers also lost Phil Jackson. Kobe Bryant missed a huge chunk of the season. It was now his team. They also lost Gary Payton. They lost Derek Fisher. They lost, I'm not sure if Rick Fox was on that team anymore. He may have retired. They lost Horace Grant, Karl Malone, obviously. They had a huge turnover of talent, and that's not really a fair comparison there, because once again, if you're going to apply the context of, well, Shaq left, let's not look at his production, but Shaq left, and look at how the Lakers played or performed without Shaq, and then let's look at how Miami performed with Shaq, but then not look at, well, the Lakers also lost a bunch of talent not associated with Shaq as well, and of course Phil Jackson, and they had coaching problems as well. They brought in Rudy Tomjanovich, and he had to quit halfway through the season because of health problems, and regardless, Steve Nash had a pretty good year, very good offensive year, don't get me wrong. But Iverson led the league in scoring. They actually moved him back to the point guard. And Iverson averaged 31 a game, 8 assists, 2.5 steals. His shooting percentage wasn't great, 43%. But once again, when you consider what he was working with, he had a rookie, Andre Iguodala. He had a young Kyle Korver, Kenny Thomas, Samuel Dallenberg, Mark Jackson, not the ESPN and New York Knicks and Indiana Pacer Mark Jackson. This is the slow center with a C at the end of his first name. They did bring in Chris Webber for the last 20 games, but this is after he had injured his knee. So for a big chunk, and they traded Kenny Thomas and a few others for Weber. Regardless, he had no talent. He had no offensive talent there. Even Weber had shot 39%, which is remarkably worse than what Iverson shot. And he was the complimentary guy to Iverson. Iverson was playing 43 minutes a game. It's just an incredible production that he was putting. And to be consistent here, the reason why I think Iverson should be an MVP is if you put Steve Nash amongst these guys, do you think they're going to be winning 60 games or even getting into the playoffs? I don't think so. You put Iverson on that Suns team with Amari and Sean Marion Joe Johnson, young Joe Johnson, and Quentin Richardson. They had lots of talent. I think Jim Jackson was on that team too as a sixth man. And you put Iverson as a point guard there, obviously he's going to be scoring it a little bit more than what Nash was. He's probably going to look for his shot a lot more. But he's also going to distribute the ball. When we saw him in All-Star games, and even when he played in the Olympics in 2004, he happily facilitated. Even when he played with Carmelo Anthony, he was happy to distribute the basketball. So once again, Iverson's had his entire career in Philadelphia was marred by that, and that's when he was in his prime. So I didn't want to beat a dead horse, but I couldn't mention his career without talking about that incredible 2005 season that everybody forgets about. Absolutely everybody forgets about. They talk about him in 2001, but when the 2005 season rolls around, they talk about Steve Nash winning MVP, and they talk about how it should have been Shaq's award. I don't think so. I would have voted for Iverson first, but Nash would have been number two. And Shaq would, I'm not even sure if Shaq would have been top five. I'd have to have a closer look at that. Maybe that for the next episode. Now, before I go for this week's episode, I did want to talk about the Cavs. And it was something that I mentioned to one of my friends during the game. It was on Martin Luther King Day. So obviously we're running a bit late here. We'll catch up. One day we'll catch up. But during the game against the Warriors, I couldn't help but wonder, is this the end? Is this the last we're going to see this Cavs and Warriors rivalry? And obviously since then, it's been more confirmed. But at that time, I thought it was a 50-50 chance, because what are the chances that the Cavs get bounced and then LeBron leaves? And I got 50% chance on that, even money. And now it's probably a little bit higher after what we saw with what Oklahoma just did to him. And also, the people didn't really pay attention to this, but Orlando nearly beat them. A couple of questionable calls there, some home cooking for the Cavs, and they could easily have lost that game as well. But more recently, obviously the Thunder game, and that was bad. That was really bad. I watched every second of that game, and I couldn't believe what I was watching, because the Thunder, they could have easily put up 160 on them. They never got out of third gear. It should have been a 50-60 point. If they bothered to play any kind of defense of the Thunder, they didn't take them serious at all. And they just sort of toyed around with them. And the Cavs, they seemed unable and unwilling to play any defense whatsoever. And finally, people are starting to pick up on this. I cop so much heat for this. When I pointed this out last year that, you know, LeBron is not a good defender. People coming at me from any and all directions saying that I insulted Christ or Muhammad or whoever people are looking to for religious inspiration these days. And I never understood it. And I think they're starting to come around. And I think people got caught up into this BS concoction from the media that because LeBron has the physical capabilities to guard all five positions, that he can guard all five positions. And that doesn't make a good defender. You can look at guys, compare Sean Kemp, who was pretty good player, right? Compare him to Dennis Rodman. Who's more athletic? Who gets up higher? It's got to be Sean Kemp, right? Who was a better defender? It's not even close. It's got to be Dennis Rodman. So it's not all about athleticism. It's not all about your body type and how long your arms are and, you know, what date of birth you are, or you know, what month you were born in, and what star sign you are. It's got nothing to do with that. It's got everything to do with your talent. And playing defense is a talent. And quite honestly, LeBron's defensive talent is highlight plays. But he's not a lockdown defender. If people want to bring up Derrick Rose as an example, I'll bring up Jason Terry as a counter to that. I'll bring up J.J. Barea. I'll bring up Patty Mills, I'll bring up Tony Parker, I'll bring up Andre Iguodala, I'll bring up Kawhi Leonard, I'll bring up all these guys that have actually torched him in the finals or in big playoff series. One good defensive performance, oh geez, how long ago was it, 2011? Does not mean you're still a quality defender in 2018. So what do the Cavs do to stop this? They need to bring in some kind of defensive identity. And I always thought, well, maybe they should bring in DeAndre Jordan, but the Clippers have done a really good job. Doc Rivers deserves all the credit in the world for this, in saving their season, because I thought once Beverly was injured and Blake Griffin was injured, that was it. They were done. There's no way they could possibly play defense or generate enough offense without those two guys. But I was completely wrong, and now they're still in playoff hunt. So I don't think the Clippers are going to fire sale and just hand them DeAndre Jordan for Tristan Thompson. And I don't think the Cavs would be dumb enough to part with that Brooklyn pick, especially when you take into account that LeBron is probably gone after this season. I'm happy to be proven wrong with that, by the way, but it doesn't look like he's going to stick around. I mean, they're already creating, you know, justification for it by saying that his teammates are turning on him, unnamed sources, because he's stat padding or whatever, which is probably true. He is probably, you know, there's only two guys that would probably have the balls to do that on the Cavs, and one of them is the guy I just mentioned, Tristan Thompson. The other one is Dwayne Wade, and I think Dwayne Wade would say it to his face. I don't think he'd run to a journalist. Regardless, what can the Cavs do to improve their situation? Well, they could always bring back David Blatt. I mean, he's still under the books, right? They're still paying him. And he was a decent defensive coach. That won't happen, though. I was just being silly. They need to... There's pretty much nothing they can do, especially if Isaiah Thomas, who we just spent 30 minutes talking about, if Isaiah Thomas is meant to be the... oh, man, this is terrible. It's meant to be the answer, which is the nickname of the other guy we were just talking about. Or the solution to them turning their season around, he's not a good defender. He is below average as a defender. So if he's meant to solve your problems, then you're screwed. You are really, really screwed. And I don't like the finger pointing. I really don't like the finger pointing, because when you look at the stars on that team, whether it's LeBron or Kevin Love, right now they're probably the two of the best defenders. And they're not good defenders at all. They have not been defending very well the last couple of years. So I mean, is J.R. Smith now their best defender? Is Jay Crowder their best defender? What about Kyle Korver? Is he their best defender? So they're going to have to make some moves. I don't know how they're going to really bring anybody in who can change that identity on the defensive end without sacrificing their draft pick. And I don't think they're going to trade that draft pick, because they just simply do not trust LeBron James to return for next couple of seasons. Now, if LeBron James was locked in, they probably would trade that draft pick, and they would get the players needed to help him out on the defensive end. But it is what it is. I mean, what you're caught in a conundrum then if you're Cleveland. And quite honestly, some of the players just do not seem to care. I don't buy into this whole... How can they be bored? Like, the people... Here they say... You hear it all the time that, oh, maybe the Cavs are just going through the, you know, the regular season, it's a long season, all that. They just got killed in the finals. Granted, some of those games were close, and they could have, with a better defensive performance, which I'm sick of saying with the Cavs, but with a better defensive performance, they could have... They definitely had the offensive firepower to compete with Golden State last year. But they weren't that far away from winning. They still have the same problems. Why don't they try to fix those problems now instead of waiting to the playoffs? That makes no sense at all. Why would you wait until the playoffs to try to fix this? Especially now when you see, as I said at the start of the episode, that the East is actually playing a lot better. It's much more competitive than it has been in the last 10 years. I don't like the Cavs' chances of even making the conference finals at this point. Who knows how far they're going to slip? And even if they don't slip, they're going to face more than likely Toronto in the second round, and Toronto will have home court. And the way Toronto has played this year, they've made a jump. From a mental standpoint, they have made a leap where they are a much more competitive team against the better teams in the league. And you don't think that they're just waiting for the opportunity to go right at the Cavs? The Cavs have knocked them out the last 2 years. This is their time. If they're ever going to be taken serious, this is the Raptors, as being contenders, that would be a great opportunity for them to completely demolish the Cavs and then probably give LeBron the best justification in the world in leaving. And even if they somehow make it to the conference finals, they're more than likely going to run right into the Celtics. And you don't think Kyrie Irving has a chip on his shoulder? You don't think the rest of the Celtics that lost them in 5 games last year, Al Horford, Jaylen Brown, those guys won't have a chip on their shoulder? Oh my goodness, they're going to be going for blood at that stage. I don't want to see the Cavs underperform again. I don't want to see LeBron underperform again in the playoffs. And I don't care about his stats. I really don't care about his stats. I want to see him play inspired basketball, the same basketball that Allen Iverson did in 2001. I want to see that. I want to see that kind of edge. Whatever it takes, whatever the team needs, I will do. If I need to score 40 a game or 35 a game, then sure, give it to me. Give me that responsibility. If I need to defend, then yeah, sure, I'll do that too. If you need me to rebound, sure, I'll also do that. You need me to set back screens? I want to see that kind of attitude from LeBron. Not, okay, well, I posted my triple-double in the finals. Everyone else has to pull their weight as well. I might sound like I'm getting a bit frustrated here, but if you love basketball, it's impossible to not get frustrated with the same BS and the same nonsense from this guy and this team from the last really 4 years. I'll give him a pass the first finals when Kyrie Irving and Kevin Love were injured. And 2016, yeah, sure, they did win it. But there is major question marks around that too. And they were down 3-1. We all know that. But incredible circumstances got them back into that series. And I'll never accept that it was just a happy coincidence that Draymond Green was suspended for Game 5. That was as calculated by the league as it could be. Because you have to take into account the fact that he kicked Steven Adams right in the nuts, and he didn't get suspended for that at all. And then, of course, they ended up losing the next game anyway in Oklahoma. But the league wanted that series. They wanted the Warriors, they wanted the Cavs, and they wanted that series to extend. Anyway, my point is, I'm sick of being disappointed in the playoffs. And they are on a train wreck once again. And people seem to think, oh, well, that's fine because it's the Eastern Conference. Eastern Conference is better this year and the Cavs are worse. That is a recipe for disaster. Anyway, guys, I hope you enjoyed episode 21 of the podcast. We are now on Spotify, so subscribe to us on there. You can get a free account on Spotify. You don't have to pay for it. It doesn't have to be the paid service on Spotify. I hope you enjoyed the show. Episode 22 will be coming at you soon.